Okay, so welcome. Today on this edition of Long COVID and Chronic Fatigue, we are going to talk to Dr. Pierre Corey. Dr. Corey is just one of the, I think, one of the heroes of COVID. He's a gentleman, a doctor who has pursued what works for his patients, you know, has really thought things through, done the kind of medicine that, if you've been listening to this series, that I really believe we have to someday return to. But on that note, Dr. Corey, a pleasure to have you. I really would like you to outline a little of your story, because, you know, sure. The people who have heard of you, and which is probably most of our listeners, you know, there's two camps, the ones that, you know, who feel like I do, that you've really, you know, brought us forward. And then there's the people who, you know, probably feel that you're out there with, you know, like sort of along in the Salem witch trials, you know. So
I get it.
Yeah. So can you just lay it out and try to like explain how this happened? You know,
yeah. Yeah, it's been an interesting journey. So, I mean, just briefly, where I started before COVID, I mean, I was deep in the ivory tower. I mean, I was the chief of the critical care service at the University of Wisconsin. I was an associate professor. I mean, I literally met criteria for professor. I just was so busy. I didn't have time to put in my promotion packet. And I was the medical director of the main medical surgical ICU there. And, you know, I was in a specialty where I was really well known nationally and internationally because I had helped pioneer, you know, a subspecialty in critical care, which was the use of point of care ultrasound. So I was like an expert at using ultrasound at the bedside to make life-saving diagnoses. And I'd worked with the American College for Chest Physicians for years, building courses, traveling around the country, teaching. And we literally kind of launched that whole field. And now any critical care doctor worth their salt, or really any critical care doctor trained in the last 10 years, is going to have really good basic skills at looking at, you know, which side of the heart is failing, if the lungs are full of fluid. And so it made us much better doctors taking care of the dying. And so I wrote, you know, I was the senior editor of a textbook that is in its second edition, translated in 7 languages. It's one of the most popular textbooks in the field. And, you know, I was pretty proud of that. I also had pioneered the use of therapeutic hypothermia early in my career. I was an early adopter of that. So I was part of New York City's Project Hypothermia. I helped the fire department and the EMS. And like, I don't know, I've just done a lot of stuff in my field, but let's fast forward to what happened in COVID. So COVID hits, I'm 50 years old. It's clearly a pulmonary and critical care disease. I am like completely like stimulated, on fire. I know this thing's coming and I know my ICUs are going to fill and I got to figure this disease out. And, you know, luckily I was a close friend and colleague of Paul Marek, and he and I were talking about protocols, like how we're going to treat this. We were just learning as much as we could, reading all the preprint servers, talking to doctors everywhere. All of my friends are still in New York City and they run ICUs there. And when they were getting hammered, I was on the phone with them every day, finding out what they were seeing, what they were doing, what was working. And basically what happened next is Paul and I and the 3 other very well-known guys in our specialty were asked to come up with a protocol. Because we had a lot of credibility, we were very well-known, and the government was doing nothing to guide treatment. They were essentially saying supportive care only, stay at home till your lips turn blue, take a Tylenol, which, by the way, Eric, is the only drug really that is shown to do harm, is actually Tylenol. It actually makes outcomes worse. But anyway, that's an aside. And so we were kind of like 5 guys with a website. And our first protocol, which we put out in late March of 2020, was solely about the hospital. We knew you needed high doses of corticosteroids. We knew you needed some amount of blood thinners, you know, and so we had, you know, and we also were experts at intravenous vitamin C. And so we had like a really potent hospital protocol. And, you know, I was asked to testify in the Senate in May of 2020 by Senator Ron Johnson, because he had found that we were a group with a protocol. And he's not a doctor, but he couldn't understand why the health system wasn't trying to figure out how to treat this disease. So he comes across our protocol and our organization. We weren't even a nonprofit then. We were just 5 guys with a website. And he saw that one of the main guys was literally the chief of the critical care service at the University of Wisconsin. So who did he call? He's the senator from Wisconsin. He called me. And I don't want to go into politics, but he was not politically favored by me at the time, but we had a really interesting, powerful conversation. He asked me to testify in a hearing, and I testified for the critical need for corticosteroids in the hospital phase of the disease at a time when every national and international healthcare society was saying not to, but we knew it was life-saving. And I got killed for that. I got criticized for that, but I didn't care. I knew to save a life in the ICU, you needed to use steroids. And guess what, Eric? I was validated two months later when a trial came out showing massive mortality reduction when you use corticosteroids. So that was chapter one. We were validated. We had a hospital protocol.
And our patients' sake, to remember is that you're talking in patients who are hospitalized the second, third week of COVID.
Yes, exactly. You're right. I want to emphasize that
first week, not when you want to be doing steroids.
No, not early on, for sure. You know, it's to deal with the secondary hyperinflammation and the pulmonary phase, which is technically what's called an organizing pneumonia, what they used to call BOOP. But anyway, so that's what we were doing. And we just kept trying to bring attention to our protocol because we knew it was doing really well. I mean, some of us were using the hospital. I mean, we were kicking butt. We were getting people off of ventilators. We were getting them discharged. And meanwhile, you know, the country's doing nothing. If that's my dog, sorry, you want me to pause for a second?
No, it's okay. Dogs are allowed. You know, loud children we frown upon, but dogs are.
So the problem became is that we continued to follow all of the studies and all of the therapeutics. And as trials were coming out, we had things that we thought might be of value, might not. We really didn't believe in convalescent plasma from the beginning. That had no physiologic basis. We weren't sure about hydroxychloroquine early on just because there was so much conflicting trials evidence. And we didn't know then what we know now, which is that the high-profile journals literally are directed at destroying repurposed drugs. And we can talk about that later. But anyway, what happened was in around early October of 2020, we were following ivermectin. We'd had it on our protocol with a question mark. We didn't recommend it. But we started to see these trials coming out from different centers and countries around the world. And they were just such large magnitude benefits. We were shocked. We had never seen anything with that large magnitude of benefits. And it just kept coming and coming. There were little analyses of different cities that had adopted the protocol with ivermectin. And they were like, a tenth the death rates and the case counts of other cities. And so we were learning about all these ministry programs and studies. And so then, and this is what sealed our fate, is we put together an early treatment protocol centered around ivermectin. And soon after we did that, Senator Johnson asked me again to give testimony in the Senate. And I was pretty fired up that day because one of the other party senators kind of offended me and all the doctors that were invited, calling us like politically having some sort of political objective. And I was just furious. I mean, I've been drowning in ICU, trying to keep patients alive, trying to learn everything I could about this disease, trying to put together protocols. And here he is like offending me for trying to share that knowledge as if I have some sort of political objective. And so I let it rip. I don't know. I just was tired, angry, frustrated, and offended. And that testimony went viral, right? And so, you know, not that it was my intent, but it really put ivermectin on the map and it became a thing of discussion. But I'm going to pause here and say, what I didn't know is I thought that information would be so welcomed and appreciated and adopted and deployed. And that's not what happened. And I couldn't figure out. Yeah, exactly. You laugh now, right? I mean,
I'm laughing only because I've been doing what they call alternative medicine and interested in it for 40 years. Yep. And I have watched this happen time. This is one of the more egregious big ones, time and time again. Okay, people come forward, they've worked really hard, they found something, and they hit academic medicine, and they become roadkill. Okay,
you could sum up what happened to me next as that process that I had to go through. But, you know, I couldn't figure it out after the testimony, and we got a lot of attention. In fact, one of the legislators even got us an audience with the National Institutes of Health, and I presented with Paul Marrick in front of the Guidelines Committee for Treatment of COVID. And we gave them all of our data. They asked some questions. We could tell that there's something was off there. Like they were very, a couple of them were very dismissive, very derisive, just sort of Yeah, it wasn't like, great, guys, thank you. It was more like they just wanted to poke holes in what we were saying. But then like the media, the way the media behaved towards it, like I just saw all these attacks and criticisms and I couldn't figure out what was going on. And what changed my life was an email that was sent to me in March of 2021. This is 3 months after my testimony, where we were just getting like criticized, hammered, censored. And there's just, I just started reading lies everywhere. Lies about ivermectin, narratives that were forming. They were just saying, you know, as an expert in ivermectin, because the other thing about my testimony is that came after I wrote the first comprehensive review paper. It was a very long paper, 200 references. It reported on all of the trials, the studies, the ministries, the epidemic. It was like an overwhelming paper. And that started to get a lot of attention, my, you know, comprehensive review paper. And then I got this email in March of 2021. And by the way, I could go through the whole story. I'm writing a book about it, but we also passed peer review. That paper passed peer review, and then it was suddenly retracted right before publication without a good reason. We didn't know why. We had four peer reviewers, three rounds of peer review, three senior scientists at NIH and FDA were the peer reviewers. And yet it got retracted, and which has never happened in our collective careers, where you had a paper pass peer review and it gets retracted without accusations of fraud or plagiarism. Like they just said, we hired a third party peer reviewer who anonymously said that your conclusions are not supported by your data. And so we're retracting it. And that's when we knew that something sinister was going on. Like we knew that this is not right here. And that's happened to many, many other people around the vaccines and myocarditis, and a lot of inconvenient papers were retracted. So, but that was the first wake-up call to me. And then someone sent me an email. He's a professor, a world expert on vitamin D. His name is William B. Grant. He's from Australia. And he wrote me this two-line email. And he said, Dr. Corey, what they're doing to ivermectin, they've been doing to vitamin D for decades. And then he sent me a link to an article called The Disinformation Playbook. And it's on the website of the Union for Concerned Scientists. And I read the article. It's a short article. It's very powerful. But it basically describes what industries do when science emerges that's inconvenient to their interests. Yeah. And when I read that article, it was like a click. Like suddenly the world made perfect sense. And because when I read the tactics of what they do, I was like, I've seen that. I've seen that. I've seen that. I've seen like every tactic described. And this applies to any industry. Yeah. It was invented by the tobacco industry, practiced right. for 50 years, right? To protect the sales of tobacco. But the pharmaceutical industry is the most skilled and the most sinister practitioners. And once I read that article, basically that describes my life, is that I have been the target of disinformation through the media, through the journals, through personal attacks. I've lost jobs. I mean, you know, what I discovered is that by trying to bring knowledge of the efficacy of ivermectin, the key thing is ivermectin is an off-patent repurposed drug. The repurposed drugs are the single greatest threat to the pharmaceutical industry. It is their Achilles heel. And I basically was like sticking a knife into their Achilles heel. And that's a $1 trillion industry. They stop it. Nothing to put you down. Now, I'm still standing. I'm talking to you. My organization is doing well. We're still putting out good pragmatic medical information. But I've had to watch just massive propaganda and censorship. And they've tried to bury ivermectin. And we talked about this briefly. I mean, their main tactic, and I just want to finish on this. And so this would help maybe some of your viewers who think like I'm a kook or I'm getting something wrong. But out of all of the disinformation tactics that I've seen, the propaganda, the censorship in social media and all this stuff, it's all founded upon one single tactic. And that is the publishing of counterfeit science in the high impact medical journals. There are 93 control trials. Almost all of them are positive. I know many of the researchers and investigators who did those trials. Very early on in 2021, it was known you could not publish in a high impact journal. They were rejecting upon submission all positive trials. And then the only thing you showed up were, I call them the big five. There's been big five ivermectin trials, each one with a non-statistically significant benefit. I want to repeat that. They all show benefits, but they're designed so to not reach statistical significance. And they're all written with the conclusion that ivermectin should not be used in COVID. And based on five trials, when there's 93 controlled trials. And then I saw what I've learned is the immense power of the high impact journals, right? The five highest impact medical journals in the world are New England Journal of Medicine, the Journal of the American Medical Association, the British Medical Journal, the Lancet, and Annals of Internal Medicine. Those journals drive headlines, they drive guidelines, they drive everything. And they've been captured by pharma well over two decades ago. Yeah. And former editors of those journals have resigned their positions and written books about the control of those journals. And so, and let me just finish here. So when we talk about that journey, where I started, I literally started thinking those journals represented the best of science, the most careful, the most expert, the most erudite opinions. That's where I started. Now, you couldn't pay me to read one of those journals. What appears in those journals is what they allow to appear in those journals. And so, like, I call myself a recovering physician now. I'm outside that system. I would say the transition was difficult because I'm an ICU doctor. I'm an educator. I've won teaching awards at all the major institutions I've worked at. I mean, I was really a celebrated teacher, and I loved teaching. And, you know, my career is over in the system. And I sort of was saddened by that for a time, but like, I don't know, after going through that, I'm really happy where I am. I have to talk to guys like you. I'm learning so much stuff that they don't teach you in medical, new physiology, new mechanisms, new therapies. And it's like almost like a second career now. And I'm so open to the fact that they've been hiding and suppressing effective therapies. If it doesn't bring, you know, money to pharma, it's gone. Yeah, I mean, they destroy it and they destroy people who claim that it works. And so I'm here, Eric. So just say welcome. Oh, I know you've been there a while, so I'm here.
it's beautiful. And but Paul, I mean, like, is it, you know, I love medicine. I love, you know, science. And I just want people to understand that at this point in, you know, for the last forever, you have to. It's not clean, okay? Medicine, it's just not, it never has been. It's always been, the people have to understand it's how it works. And it's very frustrating because we all depend on expert opinion because we can't know all the details. But unfortunately, it's not a clean cut proposition. Experts do lie, or if maybe not lie, at least are not totally crystal clear. And as I've now been saying, I think for every one of these episodes, you know, we were taught to believe in evidence-based medicine, and what we have today is evidence-bought medicine.
I was about to say they don't lie; they're bought. Experts are bought, and if you're an expert with an opinion, a scientific opinion that's inconvenient to industry's interest, because that's what disinformation is about. It's the tactics they deploy when science emerges that's inconvenient. So if you're the head of a hospital, a chair of a committee, and suddenly you start to say, just using a random example, that the vaccines are toxic or that they don't work, and that's not the consensus, you're done. How long are you going to be employed? You're gone. And everybody knows to play that game. And so, yeah, and the evidence-based medicine, here's another thing you just said about expert opinion. I really do believe if you're truly an expert and have a lot of wealth of clinical experience and insight and study, I want to listen to you. What we have now is evidence-based medicine, which is actually, shouldn't be called that. I call it the Church of RCT Fundamentalism. And these RCTs,
randomized controlled trial fundamentals. Yeah, because that's,
And randomized controlled trials are absolutely important at the bench. You know, when you're doing in vitro, in vivo studies, you absolutely need very good randomized controlled trials. When you get to the clinical level, studying humans, those randomized controlled trials have so many weaknesses. And their main weakness is that the bias of the funder always outweighs the objectivity of the placebo. And basically, I don't believe in those kind of random, like the big RCTs that are done with massive funding from either pharma or the NIH, which is the same thing. They are designed to produce the result that they want produced. And so I don't trust big RCTs anymore, unless it's done by someone independent or, you know, without massive funding or conflicts. I mean, I think science has been totally corrupted. And I used to pray at the altar of the RCTs. I used to think that those were real science and truth that was being uncovered through the careful study of interventions. That's not true. And I've had to, that was a crash course I got in 2 years of studying this and then starting to read books of the history of evidence-based medicine, the books on the history of the pharmaceutical influence and takeover of not only the agencies, but the journals. And so now I don't know who to trust about anything anymore, but I you kind of just got to use your kind of your, can I say bullshit on here? Your bullshit detector. And you kind of get to know like, who has integrity, who has sincerity, who truly has expertise, and whose opinions are truly objective.
Yeah. But you know, Paul, what's been hard is that this has been so polarizing that, you know, I said, I'm in that group that, you know, in the beginning, you know, I really felt, oh, those vaccines were saving old. I mean, definitely we're saving people. Old people in New York were dying like flies, and, you know, it seems to help, you know? Yep. And so it's like, I actually was speaking to one of the doctors I interviewed for this, that we want to get together a panel of people who on both sides of the safety and efficacy of the virus, of the vaccine, of the mRNA yeah. vaccine, to really have a discussion amongst peers and make people actually listen to each other. Because at this point, I'm not seeing that. Seeing just like black and white. And I know that the truth, there's shades of gray here. And that's what I want to get to. But anyway.
There's no more debate, Eric. The people aren't debating. I mean, I know people have been calling attention to the toxicity and lethality of the vaccines. They've asked numerous times for someone to debate them, exchange of information, to sift through the evidence of what they have and what they... And there's nothing like that. It's people pick a side and they stick to that side. No matter if the data leaves them, they stick to that side. And I don't know. I don't know what to say.
No. I don't know. I mean, but we have to come forward because, you know, the political polarization. And I said, I'm in the same place that I think you are, is that, you know, we were at one time, I mean, I still am, I think more on perhaps people would say the left wing of life. But on the other hand, I have been totally disappointed by how it's become a card-carrying society. You know, there's no longer room for discussion.
Yep.
And anyway, so but that's I got to go back to why we're really here today. I mean, this is a conversation that I think is really important. And I think it's for anyone who has long COVID, you know, you got here partially because people like Dr. Corey, I guess even myself in my small little way, because the FTC, as soon as it started, we put up on our website things that you could do. And we got a letter from the Federal Trade Commission to take it down. But the point is that, and we've discussed this with many doctors who are on this series, our patients who are chronically ill, who were the people you would expect to get long COVID, we're not seeing it. Because our patients are taking they're often on mast cell medicines. They're taking vitamin D. They're taking vitamin C. They're often using low dose ivermectin. But the point is, they are not getting long COVID. We don't have any, all my long COVID patients are new.
Yep.
We don't have any from our practice, and it's not. I mean, I was just thinking, well, we didn't have that many COVID patients because I'm in a county that locked down real hard. You know, so maybe I missed it, but talking to people in New York and elsewhere, it's the same thing. Their long-term patients did not get long-term COVID. So Eric, something we were suggesting works.
Another way, you know, a description that I like for what long COVID is, it's untreated COVID. I mean, you don't get to long COVID unless you didn't get at least effective early treatment, or like you're saying, you didn't have a strong and robust and primed immune system, right? But, you know, those who get early treatment, you know, and there's lots of protocols for early treatment. Obviously, we favor ours on the FLCCC, but there's many different ways to treat this. There's now we know of 43 repurposed interventions that work as antiviral and improve outcomes in COVID. So it's not just ivermectin, but the things that we use, it's very rare that I see a long hauler who got early treatment. I have a couple, but they're extremely rare. And they're also much more mild than the others. So the long haulers generally did not get early treatment. And really, for me, the most challenge is the vaccine injured. I mean, my practice, when I opened my practice in February of 22, I would say we were 70-30 long haulers to vaccine injured. Now it's probably 80-20 vaccine injured to long haulers. I think Omicron maybe causes a little less long hauling or a little less severe, but the vaccine injured are just massive numbers.
Yeah, no, and that's something that is being totally ignored, and we are seeing that also. But I just want to put out that the patient populations we're talking about were people with disordered immune systems, but they still were able to have a reasonable response because they had enough anti-inflammatory supplements on board that didn't inflammation get out of control. Even if it took their immune system a little longer to get control of the COVID, the prolonged inflammatory phase didn't happen.
I agree.
So because we're supposed to be talking about long COVID, I'm working hard at staying on topics, not my strong suit. Is what's your, at this point, I said long COVID and post-vaccine injury, because to me, they are the same thing. It's the spike protein that is irritated the body and in multiple different ways. But what's your best experience so far, you know, with dealing with these issues?
Yeah. So let me differentiate. So we have a protocol. When I say we, the FLCCC. So there's two Pierres, right? There's me in my private practice, and then there's me, that's the president and chief medical officer of the frontline COVID-19 Critical Care Alliance. And, you know, although we call it a protocol on there, you can't really call it that because it's really just suggestions of therapies that have good mechanisms that should work in long haul. And the list is exhaustive. You could never use all of it. You're not going to put someone on 40 different compounds. So what I do and the way I practice is very particular to me, right? We're all different kind of doctors. We have different comfort with uncertainty, different comfort with risk tolerance. We are also sometimes a little bit more organized and discreet. And I'll tell you, in the 9 months that I've been treating solely focused on long haulers and vaccine injured, I've evolved. I will tell you, when I first started in the beginning, I was talking to a lot of folks, I would say like you, although you and I didn't talk, but folks deeply experienced in the treatment of complex chronic illness. They had their pet supplements that they liked and different mechanisms. And I was just like, that sounds really good. And I was putting people on tons of supplements while treating them with like prescription medicines. And over time, I'm just going to tell you, this is just me. I'm not saying it's the right way to do it. It's just, I started to trust myself and my own style of practice. And now I'm much more discreet and targeted in what I do. I'll use maybe one or two medicines, which have different onsets of efficacy, so that I can tell which one they're responding to. And then I'll do a reassessment, and then I'll do another treatment trial. I don't like bomb them with huge pill burdens anymore. That's just what I do. So what do I do? Shocker. I will tell you, with rare exception, every patient I see, the first line therapies for me are super easy. It's almost like I don't have to turn on my brain. My first line therapy is ivermectin and low dose naltrexone. Period. End of story. Now, why do I use that as my first line? Well, let me count the reasons. Number one, let's just talk about mechanisms. The best question, I know you're going to ask me this, Eric, is why do I use ivermectin? Now, that's kind of a difficult question to answer because if you look at the mechanisms of ivermectin, it's one of the most wondrous medicines in history, right? It has anti-tumor, antiviral, anti-parasitic, even antimycobacterial. Yeah. But it has many different anti-inflammatory properties, and it binds the spike protein tighter than almost any medicine in the pharmacopoeia of medicine. It's almost like this strange gift, right? So when I'm using it in long haul, I would say the question as to whether long haul has some amount of patients that have viral persistence that hasn't been fully answered. I think sometimes it's viral persistence. Sometimes it's circulating spike that is disturbing the endothelium, triggering inflammation. So I do think the binding properties are really one big mechanism, but the others, there's 20 other possible potential good mechanisms. So the mechanisms make sense, but the real reason why is I call ivermectin, low dose naltrexone, out of all the things I use, they have the highest batting averages. Meaning when you start someone on that, I put the number at around 70% of my patients who come to me are ivermectin responders. And then that varies, right? Some are small, some are moderate, some are like eye popping. Like you give them ivermectin and they will call you in 2 days and be like, I have felt better than I felt in 9 months. You know, like, I don't want to say that's everybody because it's certainly not. But when you get those experiences, it's really dramatic for you and the patient. But I put the number about 70% are ivermectin responders. My partner, he says it's 90. So it's somewhere there. It's just a very high rate of positive response. LDN, I would say, is somewhat lower, but still very high. And I love LDN in my vaccine injured because they have so many neuropathic symptoms, like the small fiber neuropathies, the burning, the tingling, the electric shocks, even some of the motor movements, the twitching, the fasciculations. LDN has just been incredibly important to those patients with you know, the more neuropathic. And so they have high battery averages. They're super safe. They're easy to get if you go to the compounding pharmacies, right? I stay away from retail. And the other thing that I like it, and this isn't the real reason why I do it, but when you see someone for the first time and you give something that makes them feel better, you know, it starts to, you know, develop that therapeutic relationship. You know, they get to trust you that you're well-meaning and you're trying to think of things that help. And so anyway, that's a long answer to say, I start with ivermectin, low dose and naltrexone. One other thing I should say though, here's the other thing I learned about using ivermectin in long haul. In the beginning, I just kind of plucked out of thin air. I used 0.3 milligrams per kilogram. I didn't want to use the standard lowest dose. I didn't want to use a high dose. I just took 0.3 and I would use it daily. And I remember in my first 10 patients, like those that got responses, I was like, hey, why don't we go up on the dose a little bit, see if it works better. And I did that just a few times. And nobody really told me that they did better on the higher dose. So I just stuck at 0.3 for probably 6 months. And then I think I had a patient or a colleague told me about a patient where he doubled their dose and the patient did so much better. And I was like, all right, let me be more aggressive with these dose ranging. And I started to double the dose. And I would say this again, I can't be precise here. I would say out of about 10 patients, I'd say 5 or 6 of those at double the dose will report a significantly greater benefit. And so there's even a dose response. So now what I do, because when we talk about my second line, Eric, I will say nowadays, when I see the patient follow-up, if they got a decent response to ivermectin, and I start both ivermectin and LDL at the same time, I usually, if ivermectin works, it's going to be usually within days to the first week, they're going to feel a difference. LDN, because I start very low and I build up slowly, it's going to be a few weeks later. So you can tell, like, when they say they're feeling better, the first thing I ask them, like, when did you start feeling better? Was it the first week or the third week? You know, and so you can kind of differentiate which one helped. But when I see them, my second line now on ivermectin responders, and I've even done it on non-responders, I just double the dose. I say, you know what, double the dose for a week and then call me back or update me in the portal. And I, like I said, about 6 out of 10, I'm like, Dr. Corey, I feel even more better, you know, on the higher dose. And then I usually, I don't put them on, I don't keep them on 0.6 mg per kg. I'll use like maybe 0.5. I'll give them a new prescription for a 0.5 milligram per kilogram capsule. So I think that's important. It has a dose response. Not only is it the majority respond, but, you know, another small majority will respond to an even higher dose. And I keep them on it daily.
Oh, okay.
So that's how I use ivermectin and LDN.
Yeah, no, and that's I mean, I always learning, because I said our experience with ivermectin goes way back, you know, because we've been using it to treat parasites.
Sure.
But at very high doses for 1 to 2 weeks, like, you know, not very high, but, you know, about, well, as much as, you know, 30 to 40, almost 50 milligrams a day, you know, which is pretty high.
Yep. Yeah.
And I was always shocked at how many people said they felt so much better. And up until COVID, I had no idea why, because I didn't think their parasites were causing that much trouble.
Right. You know? Right.
It was only that it has such dramatic effects on chronic viral infections and probably other underlying infections that we're not even aware of. I mean, I said, I was always mystified. And then when COVID came and all the literature started to suddenly come out, I went, oh my God, you know? It is amazing. And but the things I've often used lower doses now, and you're inspiring me to go back up again and see, knock on that door a little harder and see what.
Everyone will tell, you know, I do have patients who are like, Dr. Corey, I doubled the dose for a week and didn't really make a difference. And I'm like, fine, let's go back to the old dose. It's fine.
You know, in my world, I don't expect, I mean, again, the longer people have been ill, the more their biochemical individuality runs the show. So yep. Early on, you can treat most people kind of the same, but, and so I don't expect those numbers. I think the sicker and longer people have been ill, the success numbers for any therapy goes down.
100%.
I'm happy when I start, I'm happy with 30%, you know, with a lot of people, because yep. you just got to have a whole lot of things to try. So after you've gone through your ivermectin, LDN, they are game changers. They are, just like I said, they're medications that we've used for a long time. And COVID has, you know, like written large that, my God,
yeah,
they're very important medicines. What's your next?
Line is, now we're going to do an MCAS trial, right? Mast cell activation syndrome trial. I'm going to put them on. I basically put everyone on, like, my go-to is loratadine, although I know that in MCAS, right, different patients might respond differently to an antihistamine, but I just start out with loratadine. I try to do 20 twice a day. Pepcid, I'll do 40 to 63 times a day, you know, famotidine. And then I'll always add a DAO enzyme, which they take, you know, one pill before their meals. And that's, you know, another 10 days to 2 weeks. And, you know, sometimes people don't feel different from that, but sometimes that is, you know, I almost feel like with long haul COVID, it's like whack-a-mole. I know about 5 or 6 different mechanisms that trigger a lot of the symptoms, but it's very hard to tell which mechanism is prevalent in each. Even if you take a careful history, sometimes I'll think, oh, this is mast cell, but it's not. You know, I'm still humbled by the powers of history taking. I'm humbled. You know, what truly makes an expert, and I used to teach this, is it's not the knowledge, it's not how many textbooks we've read, it's pattern recognition. And what I'm so humbled about, the complexity of long haul and post-vaccine, is I'll see two patients who present quite similarly. And for instance, ivermectin and LDN will work so well in the first one. And then I'm super confident I'm going to get the same result in the second one, and I don't. You know, and then it turns out by, you know, these trials of therapy, it was MCAS the whole time for the second one, but it wasn't for the first one. And they presented, you know, so the clinical stuff is really hard. But the second trial is, I do MCAS. And when you hit that nail, I mean, it's incredible. Like, the patients are like, oh, my God, this went away, that went away, this went away. And so, yeah, and MCAS is easy. Again, it's safe. It's over the counter. It's a, you know, 2-week trial. And when it is the thing that's bothering them, they will, you know, it's not subtle. They can tell the difference, you know, pretty early on.
Yeah, no, and for the people listening, we actually have, I think, more than one lecture on MCAS and long COVID, because, as I said, we have found it to be, you know, again, it's chronic. These diseases, in my mind, are the disease of chronic inflammation.
Yeah.
And mast cells are just one of those orchestra leaders for a lot of folks. So
and there's tons of literature showing how the spike protein really can trigger and activate those mast cells, you know. And so it seems to be quite prevalent in long haul. You know, I have a question for you, Eric. So, you know, I come into this practice and I'm learning as much as I can, starting to see patients. I'm learning about MCAS. I mean, it's not that I didn't even hear about MCAS before 2 years ago. So, you know, but here's the thing, all the MCAS folks, they'll talk about ketotifen, right? That it's like, you know, very potent mast cell stabilizer. And so I started putting that in my practice. I've been so underwhelmed with that drug. I don't know why. I'm not getting like big time responses from it. I don't know what your experiences has been. I would love to learn from you on that.
It's one of my, actually, ketotifen is one of my favorites. The thing that's dose limiting is because it's, some people find it overly sedating.
Right,
hypnotic. And I just find, you know, like 0.5 to 2 milligrams before meals but again, it's you're going to hit home runs with it and you're going to like get no effect with it.
Right. I probably was in a batting slump with it, because I kept striking out. But wait, you just said something important. I was just using 1 milligram at night. So you would have people take 0.5 to 2 before each meal.
Yeah. Yeah.
So maybe I was just underdosing. Maybe that's my problem.
Right. Well, because remember, ketotifen is a medicine that is a mast cell stabilizer and an antihistamine. It's got both components to it. And so many people are triggered, their guts are a mess. And so many, and that, and you know, the epithelium, I mean, like, you know, that's what's, you know, really sensitive to the spike protein to begin with. And so that's, so that, so lowering the inflammation in the gut really makes a big difference. And that's where.
I'll do MCAS. I find the DAO enzymes are also pretty effective. Those that yeah. you know, use it, they seem to report, you know, quite efficacy.
You know, one of the things that I think, you know, that I see over time is just the longer people have had problems, the harder it is to deal with their MCAS. Because in my mind, this is, again, my story of MCAS is, you know, people start off with different levels of allergy or tendencies, having to have, you know, mast cells that are a little more twitchy. But if you have a long-term, whether it's a toxin or a virus or a tick-borne or some low-level infection that your body's been taking care of, but that noise, that inflammatory noise has been there in the background a lot, then you get hit with something like COVID, which destabilizes your immune system, knocks down, you know, your CD8 cells, and suddenly, you know, your Tregs aren't working like they're supposed to, then that mast cell population gets harder to control. If you were doing pretty well and those low-level infections were mild, you know, when you get hit with COVID, then treating the mast cell, you can get them back to baseline quicker. I think that seems to be, in my mind, the story that the longer people have been sick by the time they get long COVID. And the thing is, most people don't even realize that they were sick, because we live in a culture where as long as you can get out of bed in the morning and go to work, you're okay.
Right. You that's know? A fair and, point.
Yeah. So that's my world. But so just when you, do you use any of the, do you use any low dose prednisone at all in your approach, or do you decide?
That's such a good question. So
I asked this because I'm a
I'll tell you why. We used to have prednisone on the protocol, and it was a collaboration with others. And I actually never liked the low dose prednisone, because you understand, I'm an ICU doc, I'm a pulmonologist. I mean, we call that, you know, vitamin P. I mean, that was like my mainstay as a pulmonologist. And I go big or go home. I don't know what 10 or 15 milligrams is. I mean, I'm used to, you know, using 40 to 60. I just felt it was, if you really wanted to control it, if the symptom burden was high and the severity of the illness was high and you wanted to use prednisone, you should use a higher dose. But the other, so that was one thought I have on prednisone. But I also don't use it because these patients are chronically ill. It is a dysregulated immune system. I don't really want to get into a regimen where it's going to require long-term prednisone. Now, I will if the symptoms are really severe. And I have had patients who actually had full-blown vasculitis where they needed prednisone. So many other things pop up. The other thing is, many people have gotten prednisone before they got to me. And it helped and they figured that out, or it didn't help. And so, like, it's not something I go to. However, let me put one caveat on that, is I have three patients in my practice. Every time they have a traditional diagnosis that the system doctors give them, it's always the word atypical in front of it, because this is a weird disease, right? So I have one with atypical ALS. She has lots and lots of features of ALS, but it's still weird to the neurologist. I have another one with bulbar ALS, which is also quite atypical. And then I have others who just have only main problem is slurred speech. And then I just heard of someone with supranuclear palsy, another atypical one, that completely reversed with prednisone. And like, after talking with this doctor who reversed the supranuclear palsy induced by the vaccine with prednisone, I actually want to do prednisone trials on some of these really sick with the progressive neurologic illnesses, just because they're really, really sick. But that's a long answer to say, it's not my go-to. It's not really part of my treatment trials, unless they're really severe and I have a sense that it might work. But prednisone is not really what I do. I'll do it in really just cases, is what I would say.
No, I agree. I stay away from, in general, one of these days we'll talk about, I find, you know, low doses, you know, again, when people are really sick, high doses are needed, but low dose prednisone, or more importantly, sometimes low doses of hydrocortisone, because again, it's sort of like vitamin D. You know,
right.
Immune modulators. Yeah. You know, when you use them in high doses, you're throwing the wet. You know,
it's like putting a blanket on a fire.
You're just. But if you use low doses of these things, you can modulate. But again, that's usually not gonna not my first step for these post COVID patients.
Eric, I think I've had thoughts at times that I'm underusing prednisone. It's just, you know, because problem is you start developing your practice pattern, working with things that work. And like, I never, prednisone was not like one of the things that I started building my regimen on. And so, so sometimes I'll even forget, like, is there a role for prednisone here? Maybe I should think of it more. It's very hard. I mean, I'm learning every week from each patient, you know, getting new insights, new tricks. And so it's hard to keep track of.
Oh, no, totally. I mean, and that's what, I mean, just as we, I know you have to wrap up. So what I say is that one of the things that I want to point out to people, because you must be experiencing, is this is the joy of medicine.
Yeah.
Which we used to have when I, you know, before it became so regimented, okay, you know, is that we realize that we don't have the answers for everybody. And so instead of, you know, we have to be creative, you have to listen to your patients, and keep learning. But now, you know, it's like I said, if you were working in your hospital and you tried to, well, you experienced it, you tried to do something that there wasn't, you know, the blessings for, you can't even try it.
Yeah, now you can't. Now you could before, though, if you had a good sense of safety, it was FDA approved, you had good mechanisms, you wanted to, before COVID, you could. I mean, what happened with COVID is
you could because you were the ICU director. But yes. if you were somebody who was, you know, like a hospitalist and wanted to use,
probably even, not. You're right.
Even probably a slightly bigger dose of vitamin C, the pharmacy would have probably slapped their hands.
No, I think you're absolutely right about it. I had much more free reign and autonomy in the ICU because I was considered a national expert. I was the top of my field. I was the director. And if I said, you know, hey, I'm here and this is working, and the patients are so sick. And so if you have a good, I was definitely supported and deferred to. But yeah. Now, last thing, Eric, or maybe we could maybe redo this another time. But so, you know, we talked about ivermectin, LDN, MCAS, you know, sparing prednisone at times. The next thing I do, and it used to be like the third or fourth thing I do, but now I'm starting to bring it up front, is anticoagulation. And I was very reluctant to do that just because that's the only thing in all of my regimens that carries some risk, you know? And so, and again, you're on your own. I mean, you're using anticoagulation for a new indication without real good evidence, right? That live blood analysis can tell you about, you know, you can see the microclot and the platelet activation, but the standard tests that are available in clinical labs, like D-dimers, are sometimes normal, but patients will get so much better on anticoagulation. And so I was very kind of reluctant and reticent to use it, but now I'm bringing it up front. I'll do 28 days of literally aspirin, clopidogrel, and Eliquis or Lovenox, and then I switch them to more of a natural anticoagulation, which is like nanokinase, serrapeptidase, lumbrokinase, and vitamin E. But that first month, we just see lots of different improvements and stuff. And so, you know, the microclotting aspect of that disease, I think we need to know a lot more about it, but I will do that as well.
Yeah, no, and that's something that, you know, again, we've seen, we've used low dose heparin, you know, on and off for the last 20 years in fibromyalgia, in some chronic fatigue people. And again, the issue has always been, it was hard to predict who was going to respond.
Yes.
Because, you know, again, it wasn't so much the D-dimers were elevated, or even sometimes the fibrinogen levels were elevated, but what does that really mean?
Right.
You know, we would measure thrombin, antithrombin. But again, at the end of the day, it was more like a sense that maybe this is going to help. It made it easier because for long COVID, it looks like we have to use things with much more risk, you know, than we were using, you know, heparin at a very low doses and in ways that are not really approved. Like under the tongue, it actually has some effect.
Interesting. I didn't know that.
It's not supposed to, you know. In fact, if you write sublingually, the pharmacist won't fill it because it's, you know, obviously it's not huge. I mean, some, you know, I wouldn't, if I'm sure somebody needs that, I wouldn't stop if that didn't work. But it's surprising how often these things work because these molecules are small. Okay.
See, I want to, we should do this again, Eric, except next time I want you to talk more because I'm giving you like my experience. You got 40 years in this.
Yeah, and I know, but you have, you know, I always say, I sometimes have breath, but you have a depth of knowledge of it. You really, you know, when it came to ivermectin, you really did deep work and put to, you know, I mean, that's what
hundreds of hours I spent.
Yeah, what people have to understand is that, so when you come forward and say this drug works and it has lots of mechanisms that support it, you know, you're not doing it because you read a few abstracts.
Right. Exactly. I'll tell you, Eric, that's the funny thing is on different, I haven't really been in much debates. So I was in a couple of them, but I don't want to sound egotistical or arrogant, but like literally I was listening to opinions based on someone whose depth of knowledge was like paper thin, but yet they were very strong in their opinions. And I was just like, wow, does this person have any idea how deeply studied I am on this drug? And so, but anyway, people are entitled to their opinions, however flimsy they are. So,
No. And that's what I just want people to understand is that when they look at, you know, at the FLCC website and understand that there's a lot of thought behind what's in there, a lot of, you know, and what I think is so impressive is that though you guys started from a very pharmaceutical based approach, you really realize how important the plant-based medicines are for really keeping people well. I mean, like, and that was my point in the very beginning. Our patients stayed well because they were on these very simple vitamins and plant-based supplements that balance the immune system. Even if it's not a great immune system to begin with, it gives it a lot more resilience.
And there's good science behind a lot. Like we, you know, when we were in the system doing our thing, you know, we never studied Nigella sativa. I mean, that's just hokey alternative stuff. But that was kind of the door that cracked open because once we saw the trial on Nigella sativa out of Pakistan, and I read the paper, just the introduction, all of the references to its anti-inflammatory, antiviral, like I started going deeper than that. Like you start to read the reference and you're like, wow, there's a huge body of science around this compound. And then we found the same thing about honey and then curcumin. And then we're just like, wow, these are really powerful compounds that they don't teach you in medical school. You know, it's like
the naturopaths and the nutritionists and I wouldn't call them botanists, but all the herbal people, I mean, they've been doing incredible work at collecting data that nobody looks at.
And that's the thing. And now, in fact, if anything, like, I don't want to look at those journals. I have a list. I have a notes app, right? And I have a list because every day someone's writing to me about this compound and that. I literally have like 40 things that I want to, when I have time, I want to go into little rabbit holes and learn more about and see how applicable. But there's so many that I don't even know where to start. I mean, I need decades of time to sort of figure out what my next, you know, little go-to compound is.
And that, no, on that, yeah, on, yes, next compound and next device.
Yes.
And next, I mean, because there are so many ways to heal. Okay. And like I tell people, everything works sometimes. And what's so frustrating is that if you don't have a lot of resources, you don't get tried too many things.
Right.
And it, for us, my heart, I mean, that is the thing about, you know, where we are today is that we have such a varied population in America. And that we don't respect that what works for people, like, you know, when you're treating everybody who has the same ethnic background and same diet, I think you can be much, your chances of success using, you know, the regular stuff is much higher. But in America, we're such a mixed crew that our predictability is not as good.
Humans, and that was the thing that I always fought against in my career. I hated standardization. I've had to fight a lot. I mean, you know, my boss was after me. He just thought there was too much variability in how we treat sepsis in the ICU. And I was like, good. It's not a factory. It's not, you know, we're not producing cars that are identical to each other. I mean, I love the variability. And sometimes I would do this more and this less. And you know.
But you see, that is not what modern medicine is about, my boy. The AI will tell us all, and we're going to plug in the numbers and get the answers. But anyway, we can go on and on about how many black holes that people have gone down thinking that they're going to get the answers, you know. But I can go off on my little rants, and people have probably heard them too many times.
Yeah. So. Anyway, Eric, it's always a pleasure, and let's do it again sometime.
Yes, a pleasure. Thank you so much. And again, thank you for your work. Because, you know, without your, I mean, I know like now it feels like it's okay, but you have truly sacrificed, you know. I mean, you really took a big bullet. And I just want people to understand that this didn't come easy. So thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate it, Eric. Thanks a lot, man. Nice seeing you.